1 Samuel 13:1-14:15. The ninth talk in a series on 1 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on October 21, 2007, at Reformation Fellowship.
The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be looking at 1 Samuel, chapter 13. I'm picking up where I left off last December or so. The passage today is a really interesting one, I think. It's a great example of how Old Testament narrative works. The authors of the Old Testament narratives, they don't give you many clues, so every clue is valuable, and you have to figure out what to make of each clue. And this passage is no exception. That's the case here as well. Which means as I'm working through the passage, I'm really aware of the fact that I am exercising a lot of judgment at every turn. And so as I teach, I realize that what I say is based on the judgments that I have made in evaluating the evidence. And it is important to me to know that as I progress through the passage, that you are assessing my judgments. You have to be active participants in this process. That is especially true this week, I think, and I certainly invite you to do that. I think that's important. I've done my job. It's time for you to do yours. I think I'm going to have to start printing my notes in a larger font. Up to now, just let me give you a brief review on what's happened in Samuel up to now. In the time of the period of the judges, God rose up in Israel champions who were charismatic leaders. That is, people followed them because God granted them a kind of charisma that encouraged people to follow them. And he would raise up different judges at different times to lead the Israelites against different foes. They had several enemies, several neighbors that were constantly trying to take control of their area and dominate them, subject them. For the most part, it was charismatic. That is, each ruler had his own charisma, and people followed him because of the charisma. But there was a tendency for the Israelites to want that to be hereditary. At one time, they wanted Gideon to become their king and his sons to rule after him. And yet Gideon had just been raised up as a judge, and that was not, God did not grant the same charisma to his sons. But one of the last judges, well, the last judge was Samuel, who God raised up to provide leadership for Israel. And as Samuel grew old, it became clear that his sons were no good. And the Israelites did not want them to inherit power from Samuel. So they asked Samuel for a king, to grant them a king like the neighboring countries. And God granted that request. God, through Samuel, warned them that would be bad, but nevertheless, he granted that request. And Saul was anointed by Samuel to be king privately, and then later there was a public crowning of Saul, and he became the first king of Israel. So now it is a hereditary monarchy. Presumably power will pass down from father to son. Saul became king, but he wasn't granted authority right away. He didn't have the charisma that the judges had. He wasn't granted authority immediately, but Saul led the Israelites to a defeat of the Ammonites. And then, following that defeat, having had results that people could look at and say, yes, he's a king, then he was recognized by the people. Now, in this passage, we'll see Saul starting to function as a king, but we'll see that he is a disappointment, and that will become clearer as time goes on, even past the passage today. And we'll see that he is ineffective as a king, and a contrast to his son Jonathan, and I think this passage is really pointing out that contrast, and that's what we'll be looking at. 1 Samuel 13, verses 1 through 7. Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 32 years over Israel. Now Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped in Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets, in cliffs, in cellars, and in pits. Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Okay, the passage starts out with a tough verse. If you'll notice, there are probably other translations out there that read differently than mine. That's because what we see here is a kind of formulaic statement that's used for kings to tell us how old they were when they came to become king, and how long they ruled. And these kinds of statements occur throughout the Bible. There are two more in Samuel. But in this particular one, when it says mine says 40 years old, the 40 is in italics because the 40 is not there in the text. All it says was Samuel was years old, kind of. And furthermore, and he reigned, and the text says 2 years over Israel. Mine has in italics 30. Why does it have 30? Because 2 is not possible. He had to have reigned more than 2 years. We have enough evidence here that that's clearly the case. So the 40 is not there, and the 30 is not there in the Hebrew text. The Septuagint isn't much help. The Septuagint skips this verse. It's not in the Septuagint at all. So the question is, what's going on here? Is it a mistake in transmission? Did somebody copy it wrong and leave out those numbers? That could happen. It's in each case, it could have been one letter that was omitted. So one letter representing the first number and one letter representing the second number that could have just been accidentally skipped. That's possible. And that's what the translator of the NASB has decided, or translators, that's what they've decided, is that those numbers were just accidentally left out. And that's possible. Another possibility is that whoever wrote this left those blank thinking they'd come back. That's what one commentator suggested. My only concern about that is, why do you put in the 2? If he didn't know what these numbers were yet, Saul's still reigning, he doesn't know what the numbers are, how does he know it's going to end in a 2? And so it seems to me that's an unlikely answer. Another possibility is that the author of Samuel is making a kind of ironic statement here. He's using the formula that's usually used for a king, saying he was this old age when he started and he reigned this many years. But he doesn't really fill it in because Saul wasn't much of a king. And the number of years is 2 years because it's 2 years, possibly, that he was effectively king. He may have reigned for 42. And we know from other sources, Acts says he reigned for 40 years. Josephus says he reigned for 40 years. So it's probably more like 40 years. So he reigned, he may have been on the throne for 40 years, but I think that the author is suggesting he was king for 2. And I think as we progress through, you'll see that Saul was not much of a king, and that's the perspective of the author. Saul did not live up to the expectations. Saul has 3,000 men in his army. Apparently, this is a standing army. And this has not happened before in Israel. Israel has only had armies as a judge would rise up, and an army would coalesce around him and go to war against the enemies of Israel, and then disband. But now apparently we have a standing army. And it is divided between Saul and Jonathan. Saul is the main commander. He's the head general. Jonathan is the other general. So they are the two commanders of the army of Israel. Saul has 2,000 of those men with him, and Jonathan has 1,000 with him. The rest were sent away, and I'm not sure why the rest were sent away. As I look at history, I am very aware that standing armies are problematic in that they are expensive. A standing army requires a lot of resources. You have to be able to feed them. And so standing armies historically have been small. And until recent times, until modern times, you don't have large armies primarily because it's hard to keep them fed, supplied. So it could be just lack of money. You just can't afford to have a large standing army. The other possibility is he's thinking that war is not imminent. The conflict with the Philistines is not right on the doorstep at this point in time, and has sent some men home. If that's true, and that could be true, if that's true, it's interesting because it would show even more the extent to which Jonathan and Saul are not working, they aren't on the same page. They aren't working together. They aren't really coordinating their efforts very well because, as we'll see, Jonathan gets things started. It says that, my translation says that Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. The word here in the plural is used very often in Samuel, and when it's in the plural, it means a garrison. So that's a unit of military men. I don't know how big a unit, but it's a group, a company or a platoon or something of military men. But here it's in the singular. This is the only place in the New Testament or in the Old Testament that this occurs in the singular. Well, I shouldn't say it's the only one. It occurs in this verse, and then it occurs in verse 4. But those are the only two occurrences in the singular of this particular word. Once again, the Septuagint isn't much help. They've just transliterated it rather than giving the Greek equivalent. But there is linguistic evidence elsewhere that the meaning of this word means prefect. So it's an official, a governmental official, a high-ranking governmental official, rather than a garrison. And I think that that makes more sense. If that's the case, what Jonathan did was to assassinate, essentially. He assassinated a high-ranking Philistine official. So Jonathan has taken some initiative, and done something to spark a conflict. I don't know if he knew how big of conflict he would spark, because it looks to me like it may have been bigger than he had bargained for. But in any case, this triggers a much larger conflict. So apparently he has gone and he has assassinated a high-ranking official. And the Philistines heard of it. News of that spreads throughout. And this really makes them mad. This is the kind of thing that they can rally around. And they are going to really show the Israelites who's boss. So Saul is appropriately scared. He blows the trumpet throughout the land and he says, "Let the Hebrews hear." This is curious that he would say, "Let the Hebrews hear." Usually in the Old Testament, the only time you see the word Hebrew is when it's a non-Israelite talking about the Israelites. That's when you see the word Hebrew. You don't usually see the word Hebrew coming out of the mouth of an Israelite. So this is unusual. Apparently what Saul is doing is he is kind of couching his statement as if it's from the perspective of the Philistines. And usually when the Gentiles use the term, it's kind of a derogatory or dismissive term. So it's as if Saul's saying something like, "Come on, you slackers. Let's go get them." And it says that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The Philistines are mad, and they come together in mass. So Saul goes to Gilgal. Gilgal seems to be the religious center at this time. And we've seen that previously in 1 Samuel. Saul goes there, and he is going to go there and wait for a period of time after which he will ask for God's favor on this conflict and the Israelites' participation in it. The Philistines do come in numbers, huge numbers, 30,000 chariots. So that's an enormous number of chariots for this time and in this place. And the Philistines used big chariots. These were three-man chariots. And then 6,000 horsemen in besides that. And then in addition to the horsemen and the chariots, it's people like the sand. So this is a huge number. This is an armada that's facing the Israelites. And remember, the Israelites have 3,000 men. It doesn't say anything about chariots or horsemen. So what do the Israelites do? They're scared to death. They start finding any hole they can hide in, any cave, any pit, any place that they can find shelter to avoid this onslaught. They're running for it. Some of them even cross the Jordan and go into the Transjordan area in Gad and Gilead. Okay, verses 8 through 14. "Now he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, 'Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings.' And he offered the burnt offering. And it came about, as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, that behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. But Samuel said, 'What have you done?' And Saul said, 'Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said, Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering.' And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Okay, nowhere does it say anything, at least I haven't found any place that it says that the king or Saul or a leader of Israel is supposed to go to Gilgal and wait 7 days before offering the offerings to God to get a blessing on their war effort. But apparently there is that custom. That seems to be the case, and that's what fits here. We see earlier in 1 Samuel, Samuel told Saul to go to Gilgal and wait 7 days, and that Samuel would come then and make offerings there. So apparently that is customary. So Saul has waited the 7 days, but at the end of the 7 days, Saul's getting really scared because he sees the Philistines amassing in huge numbers just to the north of where he is. And at the same time, he sees the Israelite people heading for cover, wherever they can find it. And not only that, as we get on further in the passage, it's clear that his army is also disbanding. It's no longer 3,000, it's getting down to 600. So Saul is scared. Time is running out. He's afraid that the Philistines are going to come any minute. So he decides, I have waited the 7 days. I'm just going to go ahead and make the offerings. And he does so. But shortly after that, Samuel shows up. And apparently Samuel's the one who is supposed to make those offerings. So Saul was impetuous. Understandably, he's scared to death. Things look really, really dire. But nevertheless, he goes ahead and does that which he ought not have done. When he shows up, he comes out to greet Saul or Samuel, and we'll see that that seems to be Saul's modus operandi. When he has done something wrong, when Samuel shows up, he goes out to meet him. And I don't know exactly what his attitude, but it seems to be, things are fine here. How are you doing? Samuel says, you've blown it. You did wrong. And because you did wrong, the kingship is going to be removed from your family. It's really a harsh punishment for what Saul has done. And he says, I have appointed someone else, and I'm raising up someone else to take your place. And that will be a kingship that will endure forever. Okay, verses 15 through 23. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. And Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Now Saul and his son Jonathan, and the people who were present with them were staying in Geba of Benjamin, while the Philistines camped at Michmash. And the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned toward Ophrah, to the land of Shual, and another company turned toward Beth Horon. And another company turned toward the border, which overlooks the valley of Zebaim, toward the wilderness. Now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, let the Hebrews make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattock, the forks, and the axes, and to fix the hoes. So it came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. So after Samuel has talked to Saul, Saul leaves with his army, and he goes north, and he goes as far as Geba. If I were Saul, I would have been devastated by what Samuel had said. I don't know exactly what Saul is experiencing, but he does pick up and carry on and takes his army and puts it in place against the Philistines. It refers to them, it says, and the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines. The term raiders here, it means destroyers, literally. And apparently the Philistines were employing the same strategy that had been used by the Egyptians in this area in previous decades. And that is to say, any time there was rebellion in the land of Palestine, the Egyptians came in overwhelming force to put down that rebellion so that a rebellion would not happen again. And apparently the Philistines are adopting that same kind of strategy. They've split up into three groups. They go in slightly different directions, but they seem to be penetrating. If you look in the map, they're penetrating from the west. They're penetrating the hill country in the center of Israel and kind of dividing then any Israelites that are further north from the ones that are further south. So Saul moves his forces just north then of Gilgal up to Geba, and he stations them there to face the main force of the Philistines. Then it gives a little background information relating the fact, and a fact that is substantiated archaeologically. The Philistines had the technology to produce iron weapons and implements. And that is new technology. That is state-of-the-art technology. The Israelites are probably using bronze weapons and possibly even some stone weapons. But they don't have iron weapons. And iron is a significant advancement over bronze. The Philistines have a monopoly on that, and they don't want to give up that monopoly. So they don't want the Hebrews to learn how iron is made. They're willing to sell farming implements to the Israelites, but in order to get those farming implements sharpened, they have to bring them back to the Philistines to have that done. The Philistines are not going to give over the know-how for this kind of technology. As a result, not only is Israel at a numerical disadvantage, they are at a huge technological disadvantage in their conflict with the Philistines. The only Israelites who have iron weapons are Saul and Jonathan. So Jonathan is going to take some initiative. Chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the Philistines' garrison that is on yonder side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men. And Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. And between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp crag on the one side and a sharp crag on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sene. The one crag rose on the north opposite Michmash, and the other on the south opposite Geba. Okay, Jonathan decides he is going to take some initiative. He is going to go out into Philistine territory and see what he can accomplish. He doesn't tell his father. This is not a coordinated activity. Saul doesn't know that this is going on. Jonathan is just doing this on his own. He's a loose cannon. Saul, in the meantime, It says, is on the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree which is in Migron. Now, it could be that it's unclear why it says under the pomegranate tree. But we do have other examples. For instance, I think it's Deborah who it talks about being under a certain tree. And that's where she judged, was under this tree. So the tree marked a location of the place from which she did her business, where she did her judging. The word Migron is usually translated, it's usually assumed that that's the name of a village or something. But we know of no village by that name in Israel. There is some linguistic evidence that indicates that this word could be related to a word it could be from a word that means in the flesh, the threshing floor. In other Semitic languages, this has that meaning. If that's the case, it's possible that what's being communicated here is that Saul is doing his king stuff under the pomegranate tree, that's his office, in the threshing floor, and that's the location where kings sometimes did their business, is in the threshing floor. And if that's the case, then Saul is here doing his kingly business. And what business is that? Let's look at another verse that's very similar. I have to find it in my notes. Let's look at 1 Kings 22:10. 1 Kings 22:10, it says, "Now the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, were sitting each on his throne, arrayed in their robes, at the threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets were prophesying before them." So here's a situation which the kings of Israel are in the threshing floor with all their robes on, and what they're trying to do is determine whether to go to war. And the prophecy and the prophets are prophesying before them. I suspect that that's what Saul is doing. Saul is sitting in his office, and then it says in the same passage that the priest is there with the ephod. The ephod is this garment that has pockets for the Urim and Thummim, which are these tokens that are used to determine God's yea or nay to their requests. So putting those clues together, I think what's happening is Saul is waiting at the threshing floor, calling upon God through his priests to determine whether and when the omens are right for the Israelites to go to war against the Philistines. So that's what's happening when Jonathan takes off. Not only does Saul not know that Jonathan's taking off, but the rest of the army doesn't know that Jonathan is taking off either. He goes without telling anybody. And where does he go? He goes to this location just outside of Michmash, where apparently there is a narrow passageway between two cliffs. And I read descriptions of this location that were accounts given by a commander in World War I, where the British Army had to go through this same pass. And in fact, one of these cliffs was guarded by enemy soldiers. And in order to go through this pass, they first climbed up this cliff and defeated the soldiers on top of this cliff in order to pass through. It's a very narrow passageway that kind of winds through between these two cliffs, and at the opening of this passageway, there are two particularly high pinnacles. And that's the area that Jonathan goes to. Apparently, at the other end of this pass is the area where the Philistine army, the main Philistine army, has gathered and congregated. So in order to get to it, they have to go through this passageway. Verses 6 through 15. Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us. For the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." And his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire." Then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us." And when both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines said, "Behold, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." Now there's the typical use of the word Hebrews. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, "Come up to us, and we will tell you something." And Jonathan said to his armor-bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel." Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet with his armor-bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer put some to death after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men within about half a furrow in an acre of land. And there was a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled. And the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. Okay, so it's given a little bit of background about the situation in which Jonathan initiates this action. And now it tells us what Jonathan actually did. And it repeats what it started this chapter with, that he turns to his armor-bearer and says, "Come and let us cross over to the garrisons of these uncircumcised." Now, an armor-bearer is not a servant. An armor-bearer is someone of importance. It is the right-hand man of a king or a commander. As we will see later in Samuel, David becomes the armor-bearer of Saul because of David's bravery. So the armor-bearer that is with Jonathan, this is almost a peer. He's under Jonathan's authority, but this is someone who has been handpicked. And Jonathan turns to his armor-bearer and says, "Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." What Jonathan is thinking is, who knows? Maybe there will be an opportunity here for us to do something significant. Let's go see. Let's go see if there is some opportunity that presents itself. And he follows that up by saying, "For the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." In other words, Jonathan is saying he's undaunted by the number disparity. That the number disparity for God is insignificant. God can overcome any number disparity. So that's not the deciding factor of whether he should take action or not. The deciding factor is, will God work for us? Is God interested in doing something here? So he's going to take action and then see if God seems to be interested in working for them. The armor bearer says, "Sure, let's go for it." Now, it's not clear to me what the armor bearer's motivation here is. Is he saying, "Well, you're the boss. I don't have any choice. I'll go." That's possible. It could be that he personally trusts Jonathan. Or it could be that he understands what Jonathan is doing and is convinced by that, that he too understands that God can save by few just as well as he can save by many. But in any case, the armor bearer signs a blank check. He says, I'm with you. Whatever you do, I'm with you. So they go, they head out, and I think that this is the scenario. I think this is the chronology. They head out, and they come to these cliffs, and they see the Philistine garrison, an outpost, a number of Philistines up on one of the pinnacles. And my guess is that Jonathan looks at the situation and tries to kind of size it up. He watches what the Philistines are doing and how they're behaving themselves. And I assume that in what he observes, he thinks he sees an opportunity. And my best guess, putting together the clues, as we'll talk about them a little bit more, is what he observes is some indication in the behavior of the Philistines that indicates that they are probably overconfident. There's something about their behavior that clues him that they're feeling pretty cocky, overconfident. And overconfidence is but a half step from cowardice. Overconfidence is putting confidence in the wrong things. And if those wrong things are shown to be untrustworthy, the next step is cowardice. Because if those things don't do it, I'm in trouble. And I think that must be the kind of situation that he's observing. So he sees Philistines up on this pinnacle. They think they have everything going for them. They've got numbers going for them. They've got technological superiority going for them. They've got geographical position going for them. But Jonathan sees an overconfidence, and he says, I know how I will determine whether this is truly an opportunity that needs to be taken advantage of or not. When they see us, we're going to start talking. And apparently that's pretty common. We see that elsewhere in the Old Testament, that in ancient warfare, it's pretty common for enemies to talk to each other over the battle lines. And they see Jonathan and the armor bearer, and he knows they're gonna say something. And Jonathan decides, if they say they're gonna come down here and get us, we will not engage them. And apparently his thinking is, then it's not overconfidence. Then there's really bravery involved there, and that's a different matter. But if they say, come up here and get us, then undergirding it all is a kind of cowardice. And if that's the case, Jonathan is thinking apparently, then that's an opportunity and we'll take advantage of it. So both of them climb up the cliff, Jonathan first, his armor bearer second, and they just start fighting away and take out 20 of the Philistines in a very small area. And having killed them, it sparks fear among the rest of the Philistine garrison, the whole army. And they are thrown into chaos because of this. And the last sentence is particularly ironic. It says, even the garrison and the raiders, and remember, raiders literally means the destroyers. Even the garrison and the destroyers trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. Remember the Israelites' response to the amassing of the Philistines? There was trembling. Now the whole thing has been reversed. Now it's this mighty army that was amassed that is trembling, and the Israelites have them on the run. This is a very curious passage, it seems to me. We have a really interesting study and contrast between Saul and Jonathan going on here, and I think it's very deliberately so. The author wants us to compare and contrast the two. First, let's look at Saul's act of disobedience. It seems to me, and this is the kind of thing that you run into in the Old Testament, the penalty that Samuel pronounces on Saul seems way too harsh, way out of proportion to what Saul has actually done. If you think about it, Saul is scared to death and has good reason to be so. The Philistines have amassed in large numbers. He's got a dwindling army. He's got all kinds of disadvantages. It is reasonable for him to be afraid. And he waits for the 7 days. He was supposed to wait for 7 days. He waits for 7 days. The only problem is Samuel has not yet arrived. And so he goes ahead and offers the offering because he wants to have God's blessing on their war effort before he starts in. So there's a sense in which he only missed being obedient by a few minutes. Why this kind of punishment for such a trivial matter? And especially if you look elsewhere in the Old Testament, there are other things that God overlooks, in fact, commends. Take David and the showbread. David is fleeing. His men need food. They stop and get the showbread, which it is not permissible for them to eat. But they need food. So they take that with the priest. The priest allows them to take it. They take it and they eat it. That is a violation of the ceremonial law that was given to the Israelites. And yet Jesus uses that as an example in talking to the Pharisees of a right kind of priority of values. So this doesn't seem like any bigger deal than the showbread to me. And even if it was a big deal, look at David's life again. David did much greater wickedness. David committed adultery. And then David had the husband of the woman that he committed adultery with put to death. Are those not much greater acts of wickedness than what Saul has done? I think in this particular situation, we really need to look at the bigger context and think about Saul's whole life rather than just this incident being the thing that's being judged. There's a whole life that's being judged here. That what has happened here is an act of disobedience that is not an isolated case, but is a pattern and is symptomatic of a heart condition, I think. I will be a little more impatient, I think, than the author of 1 Samuel would like us to be. But let's look at 1 Samuel 15. Let's start with the first verse. I'll just read the first 9 verses. I realize I'm getting ahead of the author, but I think I need to get ahead of the author to make my point. The author would like us to see this unfold a little bit more slowly. Then Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Then Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the valley. And Saul said to the Kenites, "Go, depart, Go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly. But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. So Saul is told, go and wipe out the Amalekites, kill them, every one, every animal, kill everything. Saul goes in with a large force. He wipes out the Amalekites, kills every man, woman, and child, and every animal, except a few. And it's that for which he's going to be judged. That there is something in Saul that he is not entirely committed to obedience to God. He is not entirely committed to faithfulness towards God. And that seems to be an endemic problem, not just an isolated incidents in which that's the case. So it's for that, I think, that we see Saul being condemned. It's interesting because in many respects it looks like he wants to be obedient. He goes to Gilgal. He waits the 7 days. He does the offering. So to a large extent, he wants to be obedient, but he isn't really committed to being fully obedient to God. I was talking about this passage a little bit with Jack, and he mentioned that it's reminiscent of Cain and the story of Cain and Abel. And I think that's a good likeness. Cain went through the motions of offering offerings to God, but he didn't do it in the same spirit of servitude towards God, servitude and obedience towards God, humility before God. And as a result, Cain was judged. Saul is lukewarm in his commitment towards God. Saul is double-minded. Saul is the double-minded man that's talked about in James. By contrast to that, we have Jonathan in his act of bravery. Saul is scared. Saul is frightened. But Jonathan is brave, even reckless, in a sense. Rather than waiting for the good omens that Saul is waiting for, Jonathan takes initiative. Is that indicative that he doesn't care what God wants? No, I don't think so. He's just taking initiative, but it's not a presumptuous initiative. He's taking initiative, but he says, perhaps God will work for us. Let's go see. He knows that God ultimately will give victory to Israel, and his thinking is, perhaps this is an opportunity to further that cause. Perhaps God will work for us. So he goes, and he thinks that he recognizes an opportunity. The odds are not good. This is a risky thing. It's risky not only for himself. He could die. It's a very possible outcome that he would die. And not only would he die, but it's a very possible outcome that he would be leading his armor bearer to his death. And not only that, but he could be jeopardizing the Israelite army as well. So it's not just a personal risk that he's taken, but it's a risk that he's taking for the whole nation of Israel. But his thinking is, if this is what God wants him to do, it is not ultimately risky. So the question is this a God-given opportunity? Is this the kind of thing that God is leading him to do, wants him to do? And he's not certain. It looks promising, but he's not certain. So he wants some kind of confirmation, some clarity, some more information. And having looked at the situation, he thinks the key question is, are the Philistines ready to fight or not? If they're ready to fight, I won't do it. But if they aren't, this is indeed a God-given opportunity. And so he decides on this sign that he's going to use. What kind of response does he get from the Philistines up on top of the hill? Do they say, we're coming down, or do they say, come on up? And that's not a random sign. It's not like you would typically see in the ancient world where the kinds of signs they're looking for is a certain kind of bird flying from right to left or something like that, which is unrelated to the decision at hand. Rather, he's looking for a sign that is integrally related to the issue at hand, and that is, what is the morale, what is the mental state of the Philistines on the top of the hill? So he settles on, if I had this piece of information, that would be enough to tip the balance in my way of thinking. And he gets that piece of information, and he acts on it. And God grants him success in that effort. So in a contrast between Jonathan and Saul, what we see is Saul is ineffective. Saul is concerned about counting his soldiers. He figures if I've got enough soldiers, then I can do it. And he's constantly counting soldiers, looking for omens, making sure all of his ducks are in a row before he takes action. But he is ultimately double-minded with respect to whether he is willing to be obedient to God or not. Jonathan, on the other hand, is highly effective. He's not worried about the odds. The odds are not a reliable indicator, necessarily, of what God wants him to do. He does want to be obedient to God. So he takes action and then looks to see whether God is prompting him to move forward or not. And Jonathan is ultimately single-minded, that Jonathan wants to do what God wants him to do. So we begin to see this picture of Saul and this of what kind of person Saul is. And this will be built on as we progress through Samuel a little bit further. And we'll see that Saul, he just cannot decide whether he's willing to be obedient to God or not. He is not outrageously evil. It's just that he can't quite decide to be single-minded. Jonathan, on the other hand, is single-minded. And as a result, God blesses his actions. And we'll see Jonathan the son befriends David, who will be the king that replaces Saul. So these are kind of linked together in a sense. We see this transition from the ineffective Saul, who is unwilling to be single-minded, to ultimately David, who is willing to be single-minded and a worthy king of Israel. Okay, questions, comments?
I wanted to present an alternate or contrast. It seems to me that Saul is evil. I'm thinking about when the ark had to be transferred from one site to the other, and I can't remember exactly all the details because I haven't read my Bible in a while. Mm-hmm. But and there was a man who, it was about to fall, and there was a man who reached out to grab it, and he was struck down dead because essentially of his effrontery, I think, his lack of awe and fear of God.
Right.
And to me, this, it smacks of the same thing. It feels like, you know, that's a role for a priest, and Saul steps in because he doesn't have confidence that God will save Israel. He steps in and performs a holy rite. I mean, something that is reserved for only priests. Mm-hmm. And that shows his fear for his own life, but his lack of fear for God. Mm-hmm. And I think for that reason, though the punishment seems severe, I think it's accurate. Mm-hmm. Because even apart from all the other mediocre acts in Saul's life, even if it were just this one thing, I think it shows his heart and his lack of fear of God.
Right. That's possible. The thing that stops me short of deciding in that direction is looking at David and the taking of the showbread, because one could argue that that was similarly a kind of violation of God's ceremonial law that should have been, I mean, he should have been put to death. But the way God is looking at that is he's assessing that and seeing that there is a heart in David that wants to be obedient to God. He's in this situation where he needs bread desperately. What David is doing is not an act of disrespect. I think that's what God is assessing. It is not an act of disrespect, and therefore it is not worthy of punishment. In this case, it is an act of disrespect, I think. And is it worthy of that kind of punishment? Well, in a sense it is. But I don't think the act alone is worthy of it. It's the heart that's behind it that's worthy of it. And that becomes clearer as the narrative progresses, I think.
Yeah,
and in that sense, he is thoroughly wicked, I think. And last December, I was thinking that Saul may have received a difficult historic role, a role in history where he plays a failure, but spiritually we could see him in heaven, that it's possible for one to play a very different historic role than the role that one has as far as their personal eternal destiny, if you can understand what I'm saying. And I was thinking, well, he plays the role in history of a disastrous king, but is redeemed personally. I'm now having second thoughts about that, because it looks to me like there are enough clues indicating that his heart was not in the right place. And so the judgment here is appropriate for that kind of heart.
Yes, and I think, isn't there a reference in the New Testament back to David eating?
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, that just shows that it's the idea of like the spirit of the law versus the word of the law. And David truly feared God and his heart was in the right place. And so in that situation, he wasn't judged, where,
right.
Like you said, it really
right.
represents Saul's heart that he was judged for
right.
his action.
Right.
And then just one other question,
yes.
And that is, do you have any insight into why Jonathan made that assassination? And were the people just, like, offended because it threatened all of their lives after he did that?
Well, I don't really know, but it appears as though Jonathan sees his role as, he understands that the number disparity is huge. So he's engaging in something like guerrilla tactics here. And he's just trying various things to see if he can help the war effort. And why he decided to assassinate someone, I don't know. But he's just trying to do something to dislodge Philistine power. And that's the first step he takes. And then this going up, climbing the cliff and taking out this garrison of Philistines is the second one. He's a daring man.
David, regarding that battle, do you see anything miraculous in that 2-on-20 encounter? I mean, I've heard this message preached before, and the preacher waxes eloquent about the miracle of God that just occurred, and you just kind of went over it like, oh, that they just killed 20 guys. And, you know, that, can you comment on that?
Well, I do see it. I mean, it depends what you mean by miraculous. It's not unprecedented. You know, there was just a series on OPB about World War II, and there are, in wars, there are times when a soldier will just take some action that looks like it has no chance of success, and it turns out to be wildly successful in the long run. So I'd say this isn't unprecedented. These kinds of things do happen. But I think it's clear from the way that it's presented that we are to understand that it was God at work that made this happen. It would not, Jonathan would not have been successful were it not for the fact that God's hand was in that. In that sense, absolutely, it's miraculous.
David, I wanted to ask about the practice of asking for a sign, in a sense. They said, well, if they come to us, then we won't do it, and if they say to come to them. I wanted to just ask you to talk about that. It sounds like Jonathan just sort of decided that that would be the sign. And what, I guess, what liberty do we have, or what right do we have to sort of decide what will be the sign for us for something?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know in my youth, I did that a time or two. And in my mind, the sign I was asking for was integrally related to the decision I needed to make.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, I think that was kind of immature and silly of me. And yet the what we call that is putting a police before God.
Yeah.
And that story, I don't remember the details of that story, but it seems to me that whoever it was that was asking God to drench the fleece with dew or not drench it with dew as a sign didn't seem like that was related at all to
right.
what the sign was or what the
right.
decision was.
Right.
So if you could talk
right.
about that.
I think this is difficult. That was Gideon who threw out the fleece, and he did it two times. Once he asked that the ground be all wet and the fleece dry, and the next night he asked just for just the opposite, and both times that's what turned out. That was completely unrelated to the decision that had to be made. So that was like the birds flying over somebody's shoulder. Making decisions about the future, I think we all recognize is difficult because there's so much we cannot know. It doesn't matter how smart a person is. There's just so much that we cannot know. It all depends on how things turn out as to whether action A or action B is the smarter one, and we can't know that. So it seems to me that the most important quality in making those kinds of decisions about the future is humility and recognizing that reality, that there's just so much we cannot know. And as, because there's so much we cannot know, odds are of limited value. They aren't of no value, but they are of limited value. Because even if the odds are one in a million, we don't know what that tells us about this particular instance. I am much more attracted to what Jonathan has done here than to what Gideon did with respect to the fleece. Because the fleece was unrelated. What Jonathan is doing here is not unrelated to the decision that needs to be made. He is getting more information that is relevant to the decision that he needs to make. And that's helpful because oftentimes, as I'm looking at choices, they're kind of 50-50. There are lots of things that you look at it, and it depends exactly what assumptions you make. It could go one way or the other. And you think, well, if I had a little more information, that would tip the balance. And I think that's what Jonathan has done here. And he's decided that this piece of information would be key enough that if it comes back one way, he's decided it is clear enough to me now that this is what I ought to do, that this is the way that God is prompting me to go. And if it comes back differently, then it's clear enough to him now that he ought not do it. And I think that makes sense. I don't know that there is a method to making these kinds of decisions. I think that the key thing is to want to know what God wants us to do. It's a lot like, I liken it to studying the Bible. I am convinced that the key ingredient for making sense of the Bible is to want to. that you care, that it makes a difference, that it's important to you to understand what the Bible says. I really think that's the key ingredient. And along with that comes a humility. I need God's help in this process. And I think that with respect to decision making, those two things have to be there as well. That I want to know what God wants me to do, and I'm not as smart as I think I am.
There's also a sequence of events with Jonathan in that, I mean, he could have very well said, okay, well, if they say, go down to them, that means the Lord's with us. And he goes down there and gets his ass kicked. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
absolutely.
And so he didn't. And so that adds to the evidence of his thinking that, well, maybe the Lord is with us. So maybe he did the assassination thing and thought, well, that worked out pretty well. Maybe the Lord's heading in this direction. You know,
right.
Well, maybe this worked out pretty well.
Right.
And I contrast that to, I had a friend, a young friend, and he came to me and he said, you know, I really want to marry this girl. And so I was driving down the street and I said, Lord, if this light turns green,
right,
then I know the Lord wants me to marry this girl. You know, so of course the light turned green. It was a miracle.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
And he married this girl, and yes. 3 months later they're divorced because this girl had no
yes.
qualities, right?
Right.
So he, instead of saying, wow, I should learn from this error in judgment, is like, but the light turned green.
Right.
You know, and we contrast that with Jonathan, with our lives. I mean, I want control over my future mm-hmm. and my destiny. And I think you're talking about the kind of humility that says, okay, this seems like what the Lord wants me to do. I'm going to do it, and I'm willing to get my ass kicked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Because that is a sequence of events that will lead me to finding out better kind of what the Lord wants me to do. And so it's not about doing the fleece right or wrong. It's
right.
about being in a process with God.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. I remember one time when I was young, I wanted God's help making a decision. And so I prayed about it, and I held a piece of paper like this. And I said, well, if it flops this way, I'll do that. If it flops the other way, I'll do that. And it flopped like this, but I tried it some more times and I figured out, you know what? I can kind of predetermine which way it goes. Isn't that handy? I think that's exactly right. It's not a method. I don't think we can talk about a method here. We're talking about really wanting to do what God wants us to do and not playing with the process, not stacking the deck. It's an attempt to be thoroughly honest before God. What do you want me to do? And I think if that's the case, one way or another, and again, I don't think there's a method to it, one way or another, God will steer us. And it may be through really mundane ways, or it may be in more unusual ways like we've got with Jonathan, but I think one way or another he'll steer us. Just one more and then
I'll make it really quick. Years ago when I was listening to a Bible teacher, she talked about when Moses hit the rock and the Lord was angry with Moses and mm-hmm. didn't allow him to enter Canaan. Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I would, and the reason that she brought forward for that was because he was a priest to the people, and he was also representing God in front of the whole nation of Israel, notwithstanding the rock and what it represented and, mm-hmm. and how disrespectful that was. And I kind of see Saul that way, and I want to see if you agree. And the thing about David when he went to get the showbread has always kind of been a mystery to me, because though Jesus uses that as an example of a need that was filled and that David was seeking that, those priests lost their lives. There was a definite cost to what happened there. And so I don't know exactly what question I'm asking with that, but with David, I agree that it is a condition of heart, and that's what God saw. Was the crime worse that David did with adultery and murder? And I mean, to us it seems that way. And he did it in front of a whole nation. And he was, in a sense, not filling the role as priest to his nation, but he certainly was representing God's person, you know, in control, and the king of the nation. So that all tied together. Can you speak to that just a little bit?
Well, just very briefly, in the situation with Moses, I think there is a situation in which that part of Moses' life is tragic, where he hits the rock in anger. And I think what's going on there is Moses has been used so consistently by God that Moses has lost track of the fact that his power is a gift and is thinking in terms of the power being his. And I think that is why, because of that act, God does not allow him to go into Canaan. But there is no question in my mind but what Moses ultimately understood and ultimately was a faithful servant of God. But historically, that part of his life is tragic. I can't remember the rest of the question. With the showbread, I think there is a situation where there's a set of priorities in God's understanding of right and wrong. And David was putting the priorities correct, and that taking the showbread was, I think, in that set of circumstances, the right thing for him to do. And I think that's what Jesus is indicating when he refers to that. And so it on by the letter of the law, he had violated it. But understanding the hierarchy that's behind the law, that was good and appropriate. That was exactly what he should have done. Okay, thank you.